In this hour of midday, Freddie Gray, police, and the Constitution. Two law professors join us to discuss some of the fallout from the death of Freddie Gray from injuries sustained in police custody last spring. Did police officers have a right to stop Gray on the street that Sunday morning in April? What have courts said about a suspect's decision to run from police, as Gray reportedly did the morning of his arrest? Can the six Baltimore police officers charged in Gray's death really get fair trials in the city? And going forward, how can Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis reform the department to avoid costly settlements of excessive force complaints against officers? It's Constitution Day, 2015, and we observe it with a look at the Freddie Gray case and the law on Midday After the News. And welcome to Midday's second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. Today is Constitution Day 2015, an annual national commemoration of the date in 1781, September 17th, 1781 or 87?
87.
87. Thank you very much. Amy Dillard from the University of Baltimore Law School and David Harris from the University of Pittsburgh Law School. Thank you for helping me with that date. September 17th, 1787. When the U.S. Constitution was signed by the delegates to the Constitutional Convention and prepared for ratification by the states. Today at the University of Baltimore, the UB School of Law observes Constitution Day with a series of discussions under the heading, The Supreme Law of the Land in Today's Baltimore. This is billed as a look at the importance of the Constitution in the daily lives of Baltimoreans within the context of the Freddie Gray case. The event is going to be held tonight, 5 o'clock in the Moot Courtroom, in the new law school building there, the Angelos Law Center at 1401 North Charles. That's at Charles and Mount Royal. And the event is free and open to the public. We have the pleasure of an hour with two of the speakers scheduled for the evening's discussion at UB. I just mentioned Amy Dillard. J. Amy Dillard is a law professor at UB, has been a great help to us on Midday in sorting out the legal twists and turns of the Freddie Gray case since May 1st, the day Baltimore's State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby announced charges against six police officers in connection with Gray's death April 19th from injuries sustained a week earlier while in police custody. Amy Dillard served on the independent panel that reviewed the circumstances of the death of a man named Tyrone West in Baltimore police custody. And she also served on the Fairfax County, Virginia Ad Hoc Commission on Police Reform. And Amy Dillard, I also mentioned here that you practiced criminal defense and did so before you getting into teaching in Virginia. So it's nice to have you back on the show, and always you've been a great help to us since the spring, and it's nice to have you here today.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
And we're also pleased to welcome to the show David Harris, professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh, who's visiting Baltimore today for the Constitution Day discussions. David Harris studies, writes, and teaches about police behavior and regulation, law enforcement, and national security issues and the law. And he's an author of at least, well, maybe it's more than three, but the three I'm going
to... I'll take three.
The three I'll mention are Profiles in Injustice, Why Racial Profiling Cannot Work. That's your area of expertise, actually, racial profiling. And also, a few years later, in 2005, Good Cops, The Case for Preventive Policing. And then the last time you were on the show with us on Midday, it was discuss your most recent book, Failed Evidence, Why Law Enforcement Resists Science. So it's nice to have you, meet you in person, David.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's good to be with you.
So, Amy, I wanted to start with you. A lot of people listening may not know that we have a Constitution Day, but actually this has been going on for some years. And law schools, I guess schools that receive federal funding are actually expected to have some kind of program in connection with Constitution Day. Is that right?
That's right. So any school that receives any federal funding is required by Congress to engage in some educational programming around the Constitution to celebrate Constitution Day. We've been doing that since 2004. when Senator Byrd put it in an appropriations bill. It was originally Citizenship Day, has since evolved to be Constitution Day. And, you know, I've had tons of emails today from different law schools. Some are talking about cases that'll be before the Supreme Court this year. That's a sort of a classic way to celebrate Constitution Day at law schools. And we just decided we wanted to do something a little different given some of what's going on in Baltimore and how we thought the Constitution interacts with the issues surrounding Freddie Gray and other cases.
Well, I can think of several questions along those lines, and I invite our listeners to join me in asking questions of our guests in this hour. 410-662-8780 is the number if you want to reach us that way. If you'd like to address a question either to Amy Dillard or David Harris, it's midday at WYPR.org. All right, I'll start you with my question on racial profiling, David Harris.
Sure. How's
that? All right, here, I even wrote it out, so I'll just read it to you. Okay, while efforts have been made to address it, people protesting the deaths of unarmed black men by police believe all problems between African-American citizens and law enforcement begin with racial profiling, and related to that, the ongoing war on drugs. Has there been any progress at all on this front? And if drug enforcement remains at its present level, if we have these prohibitions and continue to enforce them, how is any of that going to change?
Well, I think that's a great set of questions. The origin of profiling was, in fact, in the drug war in the 1980s and into the 90s, where you had the DEA stepping up and saying, here is something called a drug courier profile. We believe that this is how drugs are taken on airplanes or later on highways, and here is how local and state police can be more effective. You don't know where the drug loads are, which cars, which airplanes, which suitcases, and you don't know who's taking them. But if you use this profile, this set of factors that we have determined are associated with moving drugs on highways or on airplanes, you will be successful. And this was taught to tens of thousands of state and local police officers who then came back to their own police departments and taught their own. Mm-hmm. And race was a factor. It will be denied from now until the end of time by the DEA that race was a factor in this profile. But I've seen state training materials, videos, and so forth. It's there. And it was often thought that race could be a successful way to boost your chances of getting drugs out of the system, of finding more drug loads and so forth. What research showed when we got to doing research and there began to be numbers in the 1990s for the first time, what research showed is that when you use race as one factor among others in deciding who is suspicious, who to stop, who to search, what happens is the accuracy of police in finding contraband does not go up. It doesn't stay the same. In fact, it goes down. It goes down. It makes police less accurate because they're not focusing on the right thing, which is, in police work, it's all about behavior. Behavior predicts behavior. Appearance predicts nothing. And so it's a kind of shortcut that police have used at the DEA's request. And if you don't get out of the drug profiling business or out of the drug war, you're going to have a hard time getting away from profiling. Now, the good part is, A, lots more awareness of what racial profiling is and how it hurts law enforcement than when I started on this 15, 20 years ago. B, there is a lot of sentiment in the public. The public is really ahead of public officials and even police in saying, you know, this drug war, this is crazy. We lost it a long time ago. We want change. You've now got four states and one D.C., the other jurisdiction, saying marijuana is legal. And once people wake up to that and they see what a difference that can make and they see that marijuana arrests are a main cause of disproportionate arrests by race, I think we'll make real progress.
All right. Related to that, I'll switch to Amy Dillard for this question, Freddie Gray, because this is what brought police officers into contact with Freddie Gray. We don't know for sure, but maybe they knew him. He had been arrested before Freddie Gray. And the report is that he made eye contact with one of the officers and then decided to run. Mm-hmm. So I've had on my show people raise this question a number of times. Why did he run? And the police officers were out there. We send them out to do this job in the war on drugs, to stop and maybe frisk people to get drug dealers off the corners, right? Mm-hmm. And so related to that, Freddie runs. That's another question here. So what's wrong with this picture, if anything?
Well, you know, when the court authorized police officers to engage with the public on the street when they were suspicious of crime but didn't have enough probable cause to arrest them in the late 60s. The court did so under a set of facts where a 40-year police veteran detective watched three co-defendants basically case a store to rob it. He watched them for an hour, I think. I think they made 20 passes past the store and always looked in and always looked at one another. And this very experienced officer said, look, I knew they were trying to decide to when to rob this store, what was going to be the best time to rob the store. So I intervened and I stopped them. And I patted them down when I did that because I thought they'd have a weapon on them and I wanted to make sure I was safe. And lo and behold, they did have guns on them. And the prosecution against those men were for the possession of guns. And that was it because they hadn't committed the robbery. The court said that the, you know, the level of interference that the officer engaged in with the men was reasonable under the Fourth Amendment because he hadn't arrested them. He hadn't completely taken their liberty away from them, but instead he had detained them briefly for a legitimate reason to investigate his suspicions. When you're thinking about crime that's very dynamic, like robbery or casing a store to see if you're going to rob it, it's easy to look for conduct and behavior. Did someone look in a window, walk past back and forth, put their hand where you think a weapon might be? Are they carrying a big sack to put all the money in? You know, you right. can look for that kind of conduct.
It's dynamic.
It's very dynamic. When you move, though, into trying to apply this rule for citizens who are suspected of doing nothing more, say, than being in possession of cocaine. Now you're looking at conduct that's not dynamic. You know, any one of us could be in possession of cocaine right now. The only way you would know that is if somebody searched us and found it in our pocket. And so when you combine these practices of profiling to look for clues about who is most likely to be in possession of drugs, either for use or for distribution, with conduct, what you tend to get is you're looking for a certain type of person in a certain type of place, maybe a high crime neighborhood, maybe driving a certain kind of car up 95. But, you know, race is often an issue. The other thing that happened, though, was that as police officers tried to articulate why they were suspicious of conduct, they stopped pointing to dynamic situations, you know, real behavioral issues. And so they were bringing, prosecutors are bringing cases to the court where, police officers are saying, look, I was riding on patrol, as they were in Freddie Gray, on my bike. I looked at this person. He looked me in the eye. And then he engaged in furtive behavior by running away from me. And that led me to believe that he was in possession of drugs, usually, is the conclusion that they draw. And the Supreme Court has said that's enough.
Yeah, and the Supreme Court bears responsibility for this in a big way. The police aren't to blame by themselves. They are doing, as you said,
what
a lot of citizens want them to do.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court has lowered it again to the point where being in a high crime neighborhood plus seeing the police and moving rapidly away, that is all the police need under the Supreme Court's decisions in order to stop somebody and frisk them. That leads to those neighborhoods, which are disproportionately minority. It's just a free zone for the police because lots of those folks do not want to have contact with the police. They're in a high crime area. All bets are off. The law effectively gives them no protection.
Is it necessary for it to be a high crime area known to police as, a drug hotspot in order for them to pursue someone who starts to run?
Not necessarily, but the interesting thing is that the court explicitly made that one of only two factors, high crime area plus turning around and walking rapidly away. That's enough. And you think about what Amy said about all the facts, the richness of the experience of the police officer watching for an hour. I mean, this is the polar opposite. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court gave it the green light. They bear a lot of responsibility here.
We could know more about what happened to Freddie Gray and to others if police wore body cameras.
Yeah.
That's in the news here today in Baltimore because of the announcement heard in the previous hour from the Baltimore County Executive, Kevin Kamenetz, that they're going to be deploying body cameras in Baltimore County in the coming year. So when we get back, David Harris, that'll be my next question for you and for Amy Dillard from the University of Baltimore School of Law. You can join us as well. Any question you have at all, Freddie Gray, the police, and the Constitution, our theme in this hour with David Harris and Amy Dillard, 410-662-8780. Freddie Gray, Police and the Constitution, our two law professors, one visiting us from Pittsburgh, the University of Pittsburgh, David Harris, and Amy Dillard, who's on the faculty at the University of Baltimore School of Law. And I mentioned what's going on at the School of Law starting at 5 o'clock tonight. I'll mention it again. It's free and open to the public. Just go to the new law school, and if you haven't been into that building, you're in for a treat. That's a great building that the UB has now. But this program observes and commemorates Constitution Day, which today is. So a lot of our questions have to do with the law, the Constitution, and what happened in the Freddie Gray case. So, David Harris, I was asking you about police body cameras just before the break, because we had the announcement
yes.
of Baltimore County moving ahead with this. Baltimore City is supposed to move into a pilot program with police body cameras. I guess my question is, based on what you know, what can we expect from police having cameras on their bodies as they go about their duties? Is going to be effective in terms of what?
Well, I've been watching this since about 2010 when I first discovered that these were being used in the UK. It was a long time before they got any traction in the United States, and that was really after the Ferguson incidents. Mm-hmm. What we can expect to see is changes in how many uses of force there are and how many complaints. The two decent studies that have been done so far show us that when police are using cameras, they're equipped with body cameras, their use of force goes down significantly and measurably in terms of the number of incidents of use of force, and complaints by the public also go way down. Now, the numbers were almost off the charts in the first several studies that we saw. Yesterday, I became aware of some new data from the Birmingham, Alabama Police Department. They're just doing a test like this, and they are also seeing use of force way down, citizen complaints way down. Now, why would this be? What we find is that there is a civilizing effect of having a camera present, and it's not just on one side of the camera. It's on both sides of the camera. Citizens behave better. Police tend to behave better. Now, let's be clear, though. This is not the silver bullet. This is not going to fix everything. What it does is the camera is an unbiased witness, and that can change a lot of stuff. I mean, think about it. We had a citizen's camera that happened to be present when the shooting happened in North Charleston, South Carolina. If not for that camera, the only story would have been the story of the police officer. And that police officer said, oh, guy tried to grab my taser, my life was in danger, so I had to shoot him. Mm-hmm. Once that video came out, the narrative was different, and we knew it was different. And that changes something very significant. Police have always controlled the narrative. And so there was nobody else to tell the story, or the person who could tell the other story had been arrested and charged. So what this does, it doesn't change the law. It does not change the underlying dynamics of a jury trial. What it does is it locks in a certain amount of the facts, and those facts are no longer contestable. That will, I think, have a significant impact. Now, there have to be rules that go along with this. When does that camera have to be turned on?
That was a question that came up in the previous hour, and I don't think it's quite resolved.
Yeah.
If you leave the turning on or off of a camera to the discretion of an officer, I don't know if that instills trust in the public.
Well, it won't, because it won't go on except when it serves the police point of view.
Yeah.
And so I'm working with the Pittsburgh police on this very problem right now. And what I've proposed to them is that there should be some situations where it must be on, some where it must not be on, and then some where they have discretion. And they're very broadly sketched, but any police officer can follow it. And the cameras are easy to turn on and off. You have to follow those rules, or there are consequences. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a system like that, they'll be on only when they serve the police interest. And the public will end up disappointed.
This is a brave new world that we're
in. You bet. You bet.
You know, the cameras of citizens, Amy Dillard, have already changed the conversation in the United States and heightened the public awareness of these issues. And now police body cameras, a new source of evidence for criminal cases, and also, I would think, in civil litigation, right?
I think that's right. I mean, you know, I've had a couple of students who've wanted to write about this and try to develop some best practices, not for the turning on and off, but for the maintaining of the material that's gathered. How
Another
do you store
issue.
It? Mm-hmm. How long do you keep it? who has control over it, who can see it, who can subpoena it, what are the privacy, you know, issues, who owns it. Those issues, I think, are all at play. And, you know, I think a lot of times we all think that technology is better than it actually is. If you've ever tried to just watch an embedded video in your Facebook feed and it cuts off, you know, there are technological limitations on this. You can't just leave that open feed up all the time and record everything because you don't have enough storage to store it all.
Right. But criminal defense attorneys are always telling us about how eyewitness testimony is the worst possible kind.
Absolutely. I mean, every study shows it, that it's just unreliable. It's the best you have sometimes. And so the balancing that the court engages in is, if it's all we have, do we allow it, even if we know that it's reliable?
Let's take a call. Speaking of civil litigation, I mentioned that because Matthew in Cockeysville is joining us, one of our listeners who has a question for our guests. Matthew, welcome to the Midday Show.
Thanks for taking my call, Dan. So I was speaking with an attorney friend last week, and she had mentioned that the state of Maryland and, by extension, the city of Baltimore has a cap of $200,000 per individual and $400,000 per incident of civil liability for cases like with police brutality. And my question to her, and I don't, we weren't really able to get a good answer to this, was if that's the case, why are we seeing a $6.4 million settlement when the city has to know, if that's true, that they're not going to have to pay that much out in the end? It seems like a misadvertising in a way of possibly trying to settle some nerves, but without having to pay some of the cost. I was wondering if your guests could address it and maybe clarify for me what she's referring to.
Matthew, thank you. That has to do with federal versus state court, correct?
Yes.
That's right.
Because federal, I think, if they had, the suit had been filed in federal court, the city's liability would have been much higher.
Oh, yes. And there would be no
possible
cap.
By,
that's the
no
bottom
cap,
line.
Yeah.
No cap in federal court. And yeah. This would have been overwhelmingly likely to go to federal court. So the city went to settle it for what it probably would have gotten in federal court.
And remember, right. Nothing was filed at all in this case, in
no.
state or federal court.
That's
so
right.
This is just risk assessment, knowing that the lawsuits are coming.
What did you think of that decision by the city to go ahead and make a settlement with the family? It's not really a settlement. It's make an offer to, I don't know what you call this, because a settlement, that term, we're used to using that in litigation, right?
Right.
When you have sides competing. And
well, there would have been litigation, no doubt.
Yeah.
And what the city was trying to do, in my opinion, was to get this behind them as much as they could. It's imperative for a city to reconstruct the relationship between its police and its citizens, to address the social problems that led to some of this outside the police department as well, and to take a sort of hard look at all of the issues that contribute to these things and address them.
Mm-hmm.
If they're trying to do that and they're saying, you know, it's a new day, let's try harder, we're going to do these things, and at the same time they're in court fighting Freddie Gray's family and denying the liability of the city and so forth, they're going to look like they're talking out of both sides of their mouth. And in fact, they will be. And so for them, the sooner the better. And we want to get this past us and get on with the work ahead.
The president of the Fraternal Order of Police in Baltimore referred to this as obscene. And he and others suggested that this would prejudice the criminal case against the police officers, prejudice a jury against potential jurors against the police officers charged in the death of Freddie Gray, because it looks like the city's admitting guilt, basically. So where does that fall under the Constitution, that question of whether this, negatively it would influence the jury pool?
So, two
is that
things.
A 14th
yeah.
Amendment issue?
So
is that got, equal
well,
protection?
Got, yeah, so
it is Constitution Day.
It
yeah.
is. It is. And we all have a right to a fair and public jury. In criminal matters, and that's what these officers have a right to. And part of their contention has been that they're not going to be able to find 12 of those jurors, or 12 of them, then times six for each of the officers, that the potential pool of jurors is already so saturated with information, some of which is information that makes the officers look bad, right? So if the city is not admitting liability, but reaching an agreement that if the family will forego filing civil lawsuits, the city will pay this money. Not admitting liability, But we all know what that looks like to us. And certainly folks who are potential jurors who maybe not lawyers know even probably have an even more biased opinion about, well, that looks like the officers must have done something wrong or the city thinks that. You know, if everyone in the potential jury pool has that information and everyone draws that conclusion and the judge can't instruct them otherwise sufficiently, you know, let me put this out of your mind. This is not what that means. Then, you know, the claim that they can't have a fair trial because they can't get a fair jury panel is a legitimate one.
Okay. But Judge Barry Williams ruled in this case that we're going to go ahead with these trials in Baltimore City because there's a vast jury pool out there, potentially. And there's only one way to know whether people are biased or not, right?
Yeah.
Have prejudice to the point where they could not render a fair judgment would be through the voir dire process.
Correct. And the potential jurors are examined for whether they would be biased, would be able to make an unbiased decision. But, you know, I think in the end, this issue may turn out to be smaller than we're thinking about now, because I would predict that at least some of these police officers are going to opt, I don't want a jury trial, I want a judge, a bench trial.
Oh, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I have a question for you and for Amy about this.
Yes.
All right. So this came up after Judge Williams' last ruling. Some lawyers actually wrote to me at the Baltimore Sun and here and say, there's no way they're going to have a jury trial in Baltimore City. Mm-hmm. Forget it. And others say, I'm not so sure about that. I'd have to get a wink. One said I'd have to get a wink from the judge that it was okay to seek a jury trial. I don't know what he meant by that. I think I know what he meant by that. But can you weigh those two for me?
Sure.
In this instance, police officers on trial, highly publicized case, high profile case in Baltimore City.
Yeah, to put it in a really simplistic sort of way, when I was trying cases, we could try to the bench and we could try jury cases. You would go to the jury if you had an emotionally appealing case or a factually appealing case for your side. If the facts were against you and the emotion was really running hard against you, you would maybe go to a judge. I say maybe because certain judges were known to be really, really tough. Maybe you wouldn't want to do that. But it's always an option that people forget. And I think in a highly charged facts, charged emotions, and so forth, to me that makes it more likely than not that the attorneys representing these police officers, at least some of them, will opt to go in front of a judge, especially so if there is a technical argument that their lawyers want to make. That's going to more fly with a judge than a jury.
Amy Dillard.
I'll just say that, Dan, you and I have talked about this before. In one of the few cases where a police officer has been prosecuted for killing another person, and one of the more publicized ones, he was exonerated, right? He was charged only with voluntary manslaughter, so not the higher form of homicide. And it was a shooting where there were witnesses, and the jury found that his conduct was reasonable.
Talking about the Baltimore City case.
I'm talking about the Baltimore City
case. Where a man was actually running away from an officer.
Exactly.
And the officer shot him.
Shot him, yeah. And, you know, in that case, the jury found that the officer's conduct was reasonable. And, you know, as a first career defense attorney, and David shares that with me, you know, I know how to defend that case because the Supreme Court has given me good rules about, you know, officers have responsibility beyond just their own safety. But they also have to act reasonably when a felon is fleeing from them who might pose a risk to other people who are in the community. So, you know, there's some law on the side of officers, particularly those who engage in intentional conduct. I'll say that here, because particularly for the van driver, the question's going to be the degree of recklessness that he may or may not have engaged in. Setting that degree, the higher level of callous disregard or the lower level of just disregard for human life, that is a classic jury question. Where do you fall on that scale? That's a classic. We need to ask people community values and make that determination. I mean, a judge can certainly do it, just another member of the community, but a classic jury question.
I see David Harris nodding in agreement with Amy Dillard on that. One quick question for me on this before we move back to our listeners here. Can an attorney ask for a bench trial during the voir dire process? I mean, if you get the feeling you're not going to get the right jury, you say to the judge, listen, we've opted for a bench trial. Would you grant it? Or will a judge be upset that you went through voir dire only to ask for a bench trial?
I don't know the the absolute correct answer to Maryland law, but I can tell you this. Most requests for bench trials come well in advance of voir dire.
Okay.
You don't have the people in the room.
You don't even bother.
They made
up their mind before
I'll just say this. That decision's always the defendant's decision to make and not counsel's to make. And in some states, the government, the defendant, and the bench have to concur in the waiver of a jury trial.
Let's go to the phone lines again for our guests, David Harris, visiting Baltimore today from the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, and Amy Dillard on the faculty at UB. Marie, in Baltimore, your question, please. Hi.
Good afternoon, gentlemen and host there. I have a question. If a person observes a policeman arresting or have somebody on the ground and you happen to be passing by, can I stop and watch what goes on?
You are just a citizen passing by, observing an arrest in progress.
Yes. And that might be considered eye contact.
Uh-huh. Mm. Well, this is a great question. It tends to come up now when members of the public see something and they not only want to stop and watch, they want to take out the cell phone and start filming. And police officers tend not to like that. I don't want to overgeneralize, but most do not. The question is, are you interfering in some way with the police action? And that's a question of interpretation. But, you know, sometimes you'll see members of the public want to get right in the scrum there and point the cell phone camera. That I don't think a police officer would or should allow. But the public has a right to be out in public and observe anything as long as they are not getting in police officers' way or interfering with them. Now, that's the law. Things can go wrong in a hurry in a situation like that. So that's your right to do that. You just need to be careful and stay far enough away that you're not interfering.
Yeah, with my students, when I teach the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment, they ask me, can I do this? I always say, well, you can. The question is, if you got arrested for doing that, what would the potential constitutional violation be that the police affected against you? So in your hypo, Marie, you know, you're standing there, and let's say you do take out your cell phone camera and you're standing 20 feet back and just recording, and a police officer arrested you for that conduct. You know, if there was no code that you had violated, if you had not interfered with the police in some way, then that would be an unlawful arrest and one without probable cause, and that charge should be dismissed against you.
We've actually had this come up in courts in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, which is where Pittsburgh is, and the law is clear that you have a right to do these things as long as you're not interfering. And it got to the point with officers arresting people for filming over and over again that finally our district attorney was compelled to send out a letter to all of our 100-plus police departments in our county that says, we're not taking these cases anymore. Don't bring them.
Don't bring them. Don't complain about this.
Don't bring any charges against people in this county. That is not a legal arrest. Hmm.
This is Derek in Pasadena. So the influence behavior is what you're saying.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Derek, go right ahead, Derek. Hi.
Yeah. Okay. So this was my question, because I thought at some point, and I don't remember the case, police officers like wanted to use drones to look down in people's yards, and it got to the Supreme Court, and they said that there can be no expectation of privacy in a public place, and that the air above the house is a public place. So I'm like, what basis would a police officer even have to arrest somebody filming? Because as far as I'm concerned, I'm in a public place, and if you're a police officer, that's a public badge you hold.
Yeah.
So I don't even know how the arrest even gets initiated. And just quickly, some of these police officers are coming from like 20, 30 yards away to say, hey, you're filming me, I don't like it, and I'll like arrest you under the, like, in violation of the 1972 Anti-Espionage Act or something like that.
Yeah. So it's a great question. And the Supreme Court held that the police were not violating the Fourth Amendment when they looked from the sky down into someone's backyard. If you flip that around, though, to the citizen, the question really becomes whether or not the citizen who's filming is engaging in some sort of criminal conduct, like interfering with an ongoing investigation or disorderly conduct in some way that would justify the arrest of that person. You know, in your hypo and the one before, if you're 20, 30 feet away and you're just recording quietly and an officer's telling you to leave, you know, if I was your lawyer, I might advise you that, you know, you might spend a night in jail if you don't leave. But if I was your lawyer, I would say, look, if you're not violating the law and the officer arrests you and charges you and takes your cell phone and they try to prosecute you, I'd be happy to defend you on that one because I think I might win our motion to suppress.
Right. That's right.
Hey, before we go to the break, I don't want to skip over what you said about Allegheny County and that decision there.
Yes.
And I said it sounded like it influenced behavior. I mean, in other words, it was an edict or an admonishment to police officers, don't bring us crummy cases.
Right? Well, it was designed to stop the behavior of police officers who were arresting people for filming when that was constitutionally protected behavior. So the objective was to stop them from doing that. A lot of district attorneys will not issue orders like that, even when they could. They won't, because the district attorney can't actually control the police. All the district attorney can do is say, if you bring me these junky cases, they're going nowhere, so stop wasting my time.
This is going to heighten tensions between citizens and police further. I mean, we've already heard from police officers in Baltimore City who say they need backup because they go out on the street on a routine call, and there's four people with cameras around them, and so they call for backup.
It already has heightened that tension, I think. I mean, it certainly has. We hear officers in Pittsburgh talking about that. I have heard and read reports about the same kind of thing happening in Baltimore, and the officers feeling more tense because of it. Philadelphia, so it's out there. The question is, what do we do now that that situation has come up? How do we get our relationship with our police departments and police officers to a point where we can work together again? Because it doesn't help anybody when police and citizens are on completely different pages.
Absolutely true. And I'm going to ask you some questions about that after this break. David Harris from the University of Pittsburgh visiting Baltimore today, and Amy Dillard from the University of Baltimore School of Law. It's Constitution Day, and after our show today, David and Amy will head back to the University of Baltimore at 5 p.m. There'll be a program commemorating Constitution Day. I guess you'll be wrestling with some of the same issues and questions we're talking
That's
about
right.
here in this air.
Yes.
So and that is free and open to the public. More information about that when we get back. Yeah, Constitution Day here in the United States, but also at the University of Baltimore School of Law. The Supreme Law of the Land in Today's Baltimore is the name of the program in the Moot Courtroom at the Angelos Law Center, Charles and Mount Royal Avenue. It starts at 5 o'clock. My guests in this hour of the show will be among those participating in those discussions today. Free and open to the public. Nick in Baltimore, you're up next. We'll go to your question. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Great program. Very informative. Thank you for taking my call. My question had to do with the Freddie Gray case and then the officers involved in that case. Now, if some of them were to choose to have a trial by jury and some were to have choose to do the trial by judge, I would assume those cases or those types of hearings would have different spans of time. One would end quicker than the other. So then how could the results of those potentially affect those cases, or how would they avoid maybe having them affect the other cases?
So we talked about this, Dan, a couple of weeks ago.
After Judge Williams made that decision.
Yeah, made the decision to sever them all.
Yeah.
You know, I would expect that the judge is going to have some control over who goes first and making sure that he is trying cases that are the least likely to cause potential jurors in later cases to be biased. You know, one of the things that is worth remembering is there are basically three events here that the officers are responsible for. There are the two officers who are at the scene of the crime, at the scene of the arrest. And do the arresting. Then there's another officer who does a small transport and puts him in the van. Then there are two officers responsible for putting him in the van. And then there's the driver. And so those are pretty discreet bits of conduct by these different officers. And there's no allegation here of a conspiracy or that they were all acting in some sort of corporate way.
They're not charged with conspiracy.
They're not charged with that. This is, you know, all the theory here is all negligence theory that rises to the level of criminal conduct. But each person is responsible for his or her own conduct and whether that was reasonable or demonstrated a callous disregard for human life. So the bleed over is not that great, mm-hmm. as I see it in this case. Now, that doesn't mean everybody understands it as being as separate as I might try to describe it.
No, I understand exactly what you're saying, because you can't. So testimony of the driver of the van, for instance, or not testimony, but evidence about mm-hmm. him, his behavior, an eyewitness account of him, or any evidence, mm-hmm. wouldn't really relate to the two officers who originally chased or stopped Freddie Gray, right?
That's right. And that's to some extent why the trials were severed. I mean, because you have such separate sets of facts for these different people, and they can come up with antagonistic defenses, with sometimes deliberately and sometimes just because. And so the judge was really right to cut them all loose.
You know, we were
separately.
At first, because I'm just a news guy, right? But we were all shocked to see six different trials. It sounds so shocking, right?
Yes.
But actually, it totally makes sense.
Oh, it does.
The way Amy explains it.
Yeah, yeah, certainly. Yeah.
Oh, and remember, you know, Marilyn Mosby would like to have them all together because she's able then to tell the whole narrative from
beginning
to end of Freddie Gray's, you know, last interaction with the police. And that bleed over might be helpful to show this sort of overwhelming negligence that everybody's engaged in. But, yeah, I think that was a proper constitutional decision from the judge.
Yes.
Here's a constitutional question from Dave in Hunt Valley. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, Dan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm curious, is I'm assuming that the officers regularly patrolled the area that they were engaged in, and that Freddie Gray was a member of that neighborhood. First of all, did he have prior infractions, I guess, for dealing drugs or whatever they suspected him of? And if so, could those officers have recognized him as somebody that they had arrested before? And when he left, did that kind of alert them to, hey, this guy might, you know, we've seen him before, he might be engaged in the same thing? And a follow-up question is, there was a fellow in the van with Freddie who said that he was throwing himself around and making all kinds of noise, and then he recanted his story. I'm wondering what happened between, you know, story A and story B.
All right. On the first part of that, so does that rise to probable cause? Oh, we arrested Freddie last year. Freddie's always hanging out. I looked at Freddie Gray's record. He had a record of arrests, not many convictions, only a couple, really. And he was facing charges at the time, mostly of a minor kind. But anyway.
Probable cause has to come from what the police observe or what they're told by reliable witnesses about this particular occasion. The fact that he had a record is not probable cause of what he's doing right now. That's my read of it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Well, you know, again, you're looking, police officers have to look for conduct on the street that would cause a reasonable person to think that a crime is being committed in front of them. And based on what I've read, I don't see what that was. You know, the extrinsic evidence that you're talking about, you know, somebody has a reputation for being a drug dealer, or I've known this guy before to deal drugs. That might give police officers a reason to observe someone.
That's right. That's it.
But they would still need to observe conduct that rises to that probable cause level or the reasonable, articulable suspicion level that the court set out for stop and frisk.
I'm not sure we can respond to the second part of that. As to the person who was in the van for a period with Freddie Gray, made some statements to the press and then recanted them. I think also made them to police. I'm not sure what we can say about that at this
point. I'll just say this, that, you know, I think the theory that the state's attorney is operating under is that when the officers who loaded him in the van did not buckle him in the way they were supposed to, that was reckless conduct, and reckless conduct that was likely to cause death of another person. Whether he engaged in other conduct that may have been dangerous, probably not relevant to the question of whether the officers engaged in reckless conduct. But it's a complex causation question.
I want to spend a few minutes on this question. So as a citizen of Baltimore, concerned about all of this, you know, so this is what I wonder. We heard different things about police officers taking a knee. That's the expression used since the charging of six of their colleagues in this case as a form of protest, pulling back on aggressive policing. And that phrase, aggressive policing, gets me to another question. You know, we expect police to go out and clear corners. There are people who don't want to live in neighborhoods where There may be criminal activity, an open drug market or something.
Sure.
So if police don't use stop and frisk and don't – if they're not aggressive, an arrests go down, crime goes up. That seems intuitive for the citizen looking at this. So we're wondering, you know, how do you get to this balance that's needed between – you know, smart policing and effective policing and not having everybody in a neighborhood think that you're out to beat them up?
Well, the first thing to know is that there are many ways to bring public order and public safety. Some of them may include proactive or more aggressive tactics when appropriate. But that's not the only way to get to public safety. I mean, that's the great lesson of New York City in the last 5 years. There was a case in New York, your listeners probably remember, about stop and frisk. The police, who were always pretty aggressive with stop and frisk under Giuliani, when Bloomberg came in, it went up and up and up. It went from 100,000 a year at the end of Giuliani to almost 700,000 by 2011. At the same time, a lawsuit had begun over the reasons and the ways that the New York police had used stop and frisk. And as that case got closer to decision, closer to its court date, the police began to read the writing on the wall, and so did the mayor. And they began to be, you know, give these apocalyptic predictions. If you cut back on stop and frisk, murders are going to go through the ceiling. We have saved at least 600 lives through stop and frisk. No judge should rein us back in. Well, it came time for a decision. The judge said, I'm not telling you can't do stop and frisk. I'm telling you got to do it constitutionally. It came out later that the New York police, seeing the writing on the wall, had actually begun to cut back on stop and frisk in anticipation of her decision. And it went from 687,000 in 2011, way down by 200,000, then down by 500,000. To the point where now it's about 15,000 a year in comparison. And what's happened with crime? No increase in murders. It's about on pace for from 2014. And some crimes, robbery, burglary, larceny, are down very significantly. So that the thing to remember is that there are different ways to accomplish public safety. The fact that police want to, maybe don't feel like working that aggressive angle, that won't necessarily make crime go up. And this national connection, this so-called Ferguson effect or Baltimore effect, mm-hmm. based on the fact that crime is skyrocketing everywhere because police are backed off because of protests and because of Black Lives Matter, that's just false.
You don't think there's a connection between
those
two?
There is definitely no connection, right. Because there is actually no national crime wave that's starting. It's up in some cities. It's right. down in others. Right. And to connect that to the protest is to try to flip this thing around and blame the other people.
Amy, we only have about a minute left here for you on this. But, you know, as a taxpayer, you wonder, paying settlements and all this stuff, is this going to send a message to the rank and file that you've got to get with it, there needs to be a culture change?
Yeah, the best effect that you could see in the police department is just a different approach to training, that there are different ways to curb crime, different ways to clear corners even. You know, just because the Supreme Court found in one case that, a suspect looking at officers and running in a high-crime neighborhood was constitutional to detain that person doesn't mean that you train your officers to do that. Right. Every day. You can train them a different way. You can train them to better, best practices rather than sort of the bare minimum of constitutionality.
Absolutely. Like you said before, just because you can doesn't mean you should.
David Harris from the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. It's been a pleasure to have you with us on the show again.
My pleasure, Dan.
Thank you very much. And David, with Amy Dillard from the University of Baltimore School of Law, we'll head over to UB now for the supreme law of the land in today's Baltimore. That's the theme of their Constitution Day conversations taking place in the Moot Courtroom in the Angelos Law Center, the John and Francis Angelos Law Center at Charles and Mount Royal. It starts at 5 o'clock, so if you have follow-up questions for my guests, go over and see them after 5 o'clock. We're going to say special thanks to Dangerously Delicious Pies for providing these delicious pies for our guests. Baltimore's only rock and roll pie bar featuring savory and sweet pies, 9 varieties of quiche, vegetarian and vegan options. Dangerously Delicious Pies, They're on O'Donnell Street in Canton and over on the Avenue, hon, in Hamden. It's DangerousPiesBalt.com for more information. Have a great afternoon, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.